You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
Welcome to LawPod UK and to a slightly delayed look back at the defining cases of what was one of the most bewildering years in recent history. And that was before the recent scenes of rioting at the Capitol building in the United States. Perhaps more than any other year, 2020 was the year many of us, necessarily, became transfixed by the rules. The rules of elections, the rules of democracy, the rules upholding colonial-era discrimination, the rules determining whether and how you could meet friends and family, travel to work, and leave your home. In January, we were unaware of the devastating effects a new strain of virus would wreak and change the way we live, possibly forever. The death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer in May inspired protests around the world and prompted a long overdue conversation about race and structural racism, not least at the UK bar. The legal community mourned the loss of UK Supreme Court Justice Lord Kerr and US Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And in November, CNN's John King became a godlike figure during the US election for many of us who stayed up later than we should have, cheering on the results from local US county names we've already forgotten. But before we all mercifully put 2020 in the dustbin of history, I am very excited to have here with me John Metzer and Michael Spencer of 1 Crown Office Row to have a look back on the most significant cases of 2020. You're both very welcome.
Thank you, Emma. Lovely to be here.
Happy New Year, Emma. Lovely to be here too.
Mike, kicking us off with a judgment that will be of particular interest to clinical negligence practitioners, the case of Whittington Hospital NHS Trust and XX, which dealt with the tricky topic of surrogacy. Can you tell us what was it about and why is it big news?
Yes, this was a case about surrogacy in the context of damages for personal injury. It's a very important case, not only for us personal injury lawyers, but also really for anyone who's interested in the ethics surrounding reproductive rights. Just to recap, surrogacy is any arrangement whereby a woman agrees to bear a child for another person or persons who want to have a child but cannot. And that might be, for example, because they're infertile or because they're a same-sex couple. Now, the strict legal question in this case, XS and Whittington, was, should a woman who's been made infertile because of negligence be entitled to recover the cost of entering into a commercial surrogacy arrangement abroad? And that's legally a controversial issue because different countries take different approaches to the issue of surrogacy. In the UK, surrogacy per se, what we might call altruistic surrogacy, is lawful, but commercial surrogacy, that is the paying of a surrogate to bear a child for profit, is not lawful. It's a criminal offence. Parliament has legislated, most recently in 2008, in order to make it so. So although it's permissible to pay a surrogate reasonable expenses in the UK, any contract for surrogacy services is unenforceable. But the situation is different in other jurisdictions, for example, some states in the US, where commercial surrogacy is lawful and is regulated. And given the obvious difficulties in finding a surrogate who's willing to bear a child altruistically in the UK, many prospective parents who have the funds choose to go abroad and enter into a commercial arrangement there. The particular circumstances of this case is that the claimant had a cervical smear test, which was wrongly reported. As a result of that negligence, her cancer was not diagnosed and she had to undergo surgery and chemotherapy. And as a result of that, she was unable to bear any children. The claimant had always wanted to have a large family. So as well as quite substantial damages for the personal injury that she suffered, she also sought to recover from the defendant hospital trust the significant costs of entering into a commercial surrogacy arrangement in California. The principle relied on by the defendant was that it would be contrary to public policy to award damages for the cost of entering into a foreign commercial surrogacy arrangement in circumstances where Parliament has legislated in the UK to prohibit such arrangements. And it was said that that would undermine consistency between the civil law and the criminal law. And the defendant weren't making that submission out of nowhere because there was actually a previous authority on the point. a Court of Appeal authority in 2000 called Briarty, which said that it would be contrary to public policy to award damages in those circumstances. Now, the lead judge in Briarty was Lady Justice Hale, as she then was. And interestingly, the lead judgment in the Supreme Court in Excess and Whittington was also given by Lady Hale, by that point the president of the Supreme Court, until her retirement last year now. Remarkably, Lady Hale, giving the lead judgment, disagreed with herself. She held that her decision in Briarty was probably wrong then when she gave it in 2000, and almost certainly wrong now. So what changed Lady Hale's mind? Well, she said there had been two key developments since 2000. Firstly, the family courts had bent over backwards to recognise foreign commercial surrogacy arrangements, which had become quite common. And second, the Law Commission has proposed amendments to the law to reflect changes in family arrangements. And commentators, and I have to say I agree, have had quite some difficulty with Lady Hale's analysis here. The fact is that Parliament has quite recently legislated to prohibit commercial surrogacy in the UK. So the fact that the Law Commission has proposed amendments to the law is really neither here nor there, one might say.
Well, listeners can find out more about the decision itself in a terrific podcast interview with William Edis QC of OneCore, which we will link in the blurb accompanying this podcast. But Mike, one of the points he makes in that episode concerns the principle of distributive justice. So the idea that scarce compensation resources should be allocated according to what is deemed morally acceptable by a majority within that country. And when in his view, it's not clear that a majority in the UK would consider it acceptable to go abroad for commercial surrogacy, given that this is something that isn't permitted in the UK. Do you think that the reasoning is problematic?
Yes, I do, Emma. It's problematic for that very reason. It is a controversial moral issue, and it's an issue really that unites concerns from the religious side, one might say on the political right, but also on the political left from a sort of feminist analysis. So, and it puts quite various interests at conflict. And some of the difficulties there become apparent in Lady Hale's judgment, because she then has to deal with the argument, well, what do you do if the proposal is to go to one of those jurisdictions, not California, but that is less regulated, what she calls unregulated systems, where both surrogate and commissioning parents are at the mercy of unscrupulous agents? And what she might be there thinking of jurisdictions like the Ukraine or other areas in the former USSR or India. And Lady Hale's solution there is, she says, well, in those cases, recovering the cost of commercial surrogacy would not be reasonable. But what you end up with then is the court's going to have to make a moral judgment in the end anyway, because the court's going to have to decide, well, when is it unscrupulous or unregulated for somebody to go abroad to enter into a commercial surrogacy arrangement and obtain the damages for doing so? So the court is still going to have to make that value judgment. And it might be said that it would be better to follow the value judgment already made by Parliament in the legislation that we have in the UK.
As you say, Mike, it's a tricky moral and legal issue that clinical negligence lawyers will have to grapple with for some time. John, a different topic, and first on your list is not one but two closely linked cases involving vicarious liability, Barclays and various claimants, and the Supreme Court decision in Morrison's. Can you tell us first a little bit about the facts of Barclays?
This case was group litigation against Barclays Bank, arising from sexual assaults committed in the 1970s and 1980s by a now deceased GP called Dr. Bates. Dr. Bates was self-employed, and part of his practice included conducting medical assessments for prospective employees, because the employees had to pass pre-employment medical checks as part of the recruitment process. Barclays would arrange the appointments with Dr. Bates, and they'd give him a pro forma, which was entitled the Barclays Confidential Medical Report. If Dr. Bates concluded that it was satisfactory, then the job offer would be confirmed, subject to the applicant passing the relevant exams. Dr. Bates did these medical examinations at his home, and they were done without a chaperone. And it's alleged that he sexually assaulted 126 claimants during their medical examinations. He died in 2009, and the claimants brought the claim against Barclays Bank on a vicarious liability basis. And the Court of Appeal had said that there was vicarious liability. Supreme Court disagreed. It reversed the decision. Another judgment of Lady Hale. She said that the question of whether a person could be made vicariously liable for a tort committed by another person requires a two-stage test. First of all, whether there is a relationship which makes it proper for the law to make one pay for the fault of the other. And the traditional relationship is employer and employee, but more recently that has broadened. Second test is the connection between that relationship and the actual wrongdoing. And the traditional understanding is that the tort needs to be committed within the course or the scope of the employment. But again, that has also been broadened in recent times. Stage two is the Morrison's case that we'll look at. Barclay's case was about stage one. And the court held that because Dr. Bates was never an employee, because he was paid a fee for each report rather than a general retainer, because he was always free to refuse an examination and was essentially seen as carrying on a business on his own account, he wasn't seen as even being close enough to an employee to be vicariously liable. The key question the court says is whether the tortfeasor is carrying on business on his own account or whether it's actually akin to employment. And if it's in the first case, then that first stage won't be met. The court had to engage with the fact that there's a lot of legal background about that stage one. And there's an important decision called Christian Brothers, which sets out five factors that point towards a relationship being akin to employment. And those factors have tended to be applied so as to broaden the circumstance of vicarious liability. They include factors like whether the activity was being carried out by a person doing the business activity of the potential employer, or whether the potential employer was responsible for creating the risk of the tort being committed. What the court said in Barclays is that you only look at those factors if the answer to stage one is unclear. So in a sense, by saying that you don't always have to look at those factors, the Supreme Court seems to be reining in the expansion of vicarious liability.
And why is Morrison significant?
Morrison's was about stage two, so the question of whether the tort's committed within the scope of the employment or the quasi-employment. In this case, an employee called Andrew Skelton became very disaffected after being disciplined for minor misconduct. His response was to wage a campaign of vengeance, which included sending workforce payroll data to the newspapers. But the newspapers alerted Morrison's to the data breach. The claimants were some of the victims of the data breach, and part of their claim was in vicarious liability against Morrison's. Again, the Court of Appeal said that there was vicarious liability. Again, the Supreme Court overturned this. Lord Reed said that you don't have that close connection in this case. Just because the job gave Mr. Skelton the opportunity to commit the act, that wasn't seen as enough. The criminality was done for highly personal reasons. It was held really to be a frolic of his own. It wasn't held to be something that took place within the scope of his employment.
So what do you think these cases are going to mean for how we apply the law now?
I think the distinction in Barclays between a person carrying on business in their own account and a person in a relationship akin to employment is easier to state than I think it is to apply. If you think, for example, about medical consultations that might take place in a practice where the doctor or the nurse has been engaged by the practice to carry it out, but it's on the practice's own premises, it becomes difficult to know whether this person is carrying on business on their own account because they're not an employee. But then on the other hand, the business risk seems to be being borne by the medical practice. And if the practitioner does a bad job, it seems like it's the practice that will suffer the loss of reputation. So I'm looking forward to seeing some more cases that apply the Barclays decision to get a greater understanding about how the law now works in practice.
On a different note, the case of Shamima Begum continued to make headlines in 2020. Mike, can you explain where we are with the case to date? I should, of course, mention that Angus McCullough QC of One Court acted as special advocate in that case.
Yes, Emma, this is a long-running legal saga and it looks like it's set to continue for some time yet. Listeners will remember Shamima Begum was the Bethnal Green schoolgirl who fled her parents to go to Syria and marry an ISIS operative during the civil war there. And years later, she was found by a journalist in a refugee camp and gave an interview which sparked quite a lot of public outrage because of her lack of remorse. So the Home Secretary deprived her of her citizenship, and she's been pursuing an appeal against that decision through her lawyers in the UK. The first stage of that appeal was to go to a tribunal called the Special Immigration Appeals Commission, or SIAC, which is the special tribunal for considering national security cases of that kind. And she lost her appeal there, but then she succeeded in her appeal to the Court of Appeal this year. And the Home Secretary has appealed against that decision, and that's now gone to the Supreme Court. And basically, there are three legal hurdles that the Secretary of State has to jump over before it can strip Shamima Begum of British citizenship. The first was that the Secretary of State has to show that stripping her of citizenship would not make her stateless in law. And the government succeeded on that point in the SIAC, and she hasn't appealed. The SIAC held that although Ms. Begum had never been to Bangladesh, she had a Bangladeshi citizenship through her parents by operation of Bangladeshi law. And so she was automatically a Bangladeshi citizen, despite the fact that Bangladesh have expressly said that they would refuse to allow her to go there. The second hurdle that the government has to get over is that they have a policy that they won't remove citizenship from somebody if doing so would expose them to a real risk of treatment contrary to Article 2, that protects the right to life, or Article 3, which prohibits inhuman or degrading treatment of the European Convention. So the Secretary of State said to the SIAC on that point, well, we accept that the conditions in the refugee camp may meet the threshold of Article 3. And it's important to point out there that Shamima Begum had a child in the camp, and that child died from pneumonia because of a lack of treatment that she was receiving there. So there clearly is a real risk to life or inhuman degrading treatment if she's left to sort of rot there. But the fact that she suffers that threshold of treatment is no fault of the Secretary of State. It's just her decision to have left to Syria, because it's not as a result of stripping her of her citizenship that she suffers inhuman treatment. And the SIAC said, well, that's a rational approach. And the Court of Appeal said, no, the SIAC hasn't taken the right approach there. What the SIAC should have done is considered for itself, as an appeal tribunal, whether there was a real risk of treatment contrary to Article 2 or 3 occasioned because of the stripping of citizenship. So that issue is going to have to go back to the SIAC. But before we get there, the government's got a third hurdle, and this is really the most problematic issue. Can Ms. Begum receive a fair hearing of her appeal, given that she's currently in a refugee camp and there's no meaningful way that she can communicate with her lawyers or participate in the hearing in any other way? On that, the SIAC agreed with her lawyers that Ms. Begum couldn't meaningfully participate and therefore she couldn't get a fair hearing. However, it said, we're not just going to allow her appeal on that basis, but instead what we'll do is we'll stay the appeal and then she can pursue it if her circumstances ever change. And the Court of Appeal said, no, that's wrong. Once you've accepted that she can't get a fair hearing, it's unthinkable to just press on with the appeal or stay the appeal in her absence. And the Court of Appeal spent some time looking through all the various options. And in the end, it came down to saying, well, the only option really here is that the Secretary of State will have to grant Shamima Begum leave to enter the UK so that she can participate in her appeal in country. And so on that basis, the Court of Appeal ordered effectively the Secretary of State to grant her leave to enter. Now, naturally, Priti Patel, the Secretary of State, is not happy about that conclusion, because if Shamima Begum is let back into the country, then it's very unlikely, even if the government succeeds in stripping her of her citizenship, that it'll ever be able to remove her. There's nowhere really for her to be removed to. That case was heard in November, and we await the Supreme Court's judgment.
And Mike, before we began this podcast, you mentioned that you had an explosive prediction for 2021.
Yes, well, my prediction would be if the Supreme Court does dismiss the government's appeal, which I would consider to be quite likely, then given the issue at stake here, given the political issues and the emotiveness around this, and given the personality and views of this Secretary of State in particular, Priti Patel, I would predict there to be quite an explosive conflict potentially between the Home Secretary and the UK Supreme Court, and we would see how that conflict might play out in 2021.
It's interesting you should mention that, Mike, because 2020 also saw unprecedented verbal attacks on lawyers, this time not by the media, but by the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister himself. John, what did you make of some of the attacks in particular on immigration lawyers, given that you practice in this area?
I think there's no doubt that there's a real debate about human rights to be had, with arguments on both sides. But it's troubling to me that the government seems particularly angry when it loses cases in court, because if the real attack is on immigration lawyers who succeed on behalf of their clients, I think that's a very difficult complaint to sustain. So I think it would be better if we had a discussion of the issues rather than making it into a personal thing where lawyers are attacked for doing their job.
And I'd agree that it is very concerning, and not to overstate things, but the very recent events in Washington have shown us how easily verbal attacks and language can escalate into physical violence. And we actually saw that in 2020 in September when there was a knife attack at an immigration firm, which appears to have been inspired, as it were, by some of the rhetoric in the papers against immigration lawyers. So it's very concerning for lawyers, but also for the rule of law.
I totally agree. I think it's one of the reasons why the work of the Bar Council, the Law Society, and really the legal profession as a whole, putting forward a united front in calling out the attacks and ensuring that they don't go unchallenged, is so important. But the Home Secretary's attempts to deport individuals continue to make regular headlines throughout 2020. And Mike, you have put the particularly tricky case of AM Zimbabwe on your list of top cases. Can you tell us about the significance of that case?
Yes, immigration continues to be a hot topic inside as well as outside the courtroom. So I think it's important for us to look at immigration cases. And AM Zimbabwe is a very important one, perhaps the most important for some years. Lord Wilson, in his judgment, which, by the way, is a very clear and well-written judgment, expresses the issue at the outset. He says, this is one of the most controversial questions which the law of human rights can generate. And that is, what do you do when you have, on the one hand, a foreign national who's committed a string of very serious criminal offences, and then on the other, that person is so seriously ill that if you were to remove them to their country of origin, where they can't access medical treatment, they would be likely to fall seriously ill or die. At what point does that removal, as it were, reach the threshold of inhuman and degrading treatment, which is prohibited under Article 3 of the Convention? And Lord Wilson notes that those two considerations, public policy on the one hand and private existential need on the other, clash like warriors. And it's upon the court there lies a heavy burden in determining which should, under the law, prevail. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Lord Wilson, and he's unanimous in the Supreme Court, concludes that it's the rights of the individual that has to prevail when one's considering Article 3 of the Convention. Immigration practitioners will be familiar with the test in these healthcare, what we call Article 3 healthcare cases, as it previously was, and that was set out in a Strasbourg case called D, and then a House of Lords case called N. To summarise that test, it's really that you had to be on your deathbed. The House of Lords said that you had to be at such a critical stage that it would be inhuman to deprive the person of the care that they were receiving and send them home to an early death unless there's care there to enable them to meet that fate with dignity. That was a very high threshold for appellants to meet, and not surprisingly, very few did. And then in 2017, along came the Strasbourg with a case called Paprashvili. They said that they were clarifying the test in Article 3 medical cases in true Strasbourg style. But what really they did is they changed the test. And what they said is, it's not just cases where the person is dying or will die imminently on return to their home country. There's also a duty under Article 3 not to remove someone where they would be exposed to a serious, rapid and irreversible decline in their health, resulting in intense suffering, or they would be exposed to a significant reduction in life expectancy. So the first question for the Supreme Court in AM Zimbabwe was, should we follow Strasbourg's new test as set out in Paprashvili? And Lord Wilson deals with that pretty quickly and says, yes, we should, this is not one of those cases we should depart from Strasbourg, and we already had expressed some concerns about the existing test, which was very, very strict. The second question is, well, what does the Papashvili test mean? The Court of Appeal had got that wrong. They sort of elided the limbs of the Papashvili test and said you had to show that somebody was going to suffer intense suffering or death because of the non-availability of medication in their home country. And Lord Wilson says, no, that's wrong. The Strasbourg court clearly meant something broader than that. There are two limbs to the test. You either show intense suffering, an irreversible decline in health, or a significant reduction in life expectancy is enough to satisfy the Article 3 test. So then the third question for the court, well, what is a significant reduction in life expectancy? And in that context, the court said significant means substantial. I'm not sure that's really much of a clarification, but what is substantial will depend on the circumstances. And Lord Wilson gives the extreme examples. Let's say you have a 74-year-old who's facing a reduction in their life expectancy to 2 years. That's not likely to be significant. But if you have a 24-year-old who's going to be removed and as a result of not being able to access treatment, their life expectancy would be reduced from their full life expectancy to 2 years, well, that may well be significant. So it's not a surprising judgment given that the Strasbourg court had already ruled on the point, but it's nonetheless very important. It's much easier to satisfy the Article 3 medical test. Depending on your political viewpoint, you might think that's a good or a bad thing. But for me and my clients, I've already seen an impact and seen some very vulnerable people, not all of whom, of course, are foreign national criminals. Many are just trying to regularize their status. And as a result of being able to do so now, are able to live their final years in the UK in some dignity.
Just quickly on the point about reduction in life expectancy of the person in their 70s, I always think about the fact that one of my great grandmothers lived to be 101. So I'm not sure if it's necessarily a good rule of thumb. But there's one other thing to add, which is that there's also a Strasbourg decision in the case of Savran and Denmark, which is quite important. This was a case about a person with paranoid schizophrenia, and the Danish government wanted to deport him to Turkey. But he needed daily medication, and he was resident on a closed ward. And the evidence is that if he loses access to any of that treatment, then his psychotic symptoms are likely to worsen. His whole family lives in Denmark, and the question was whether he'd be able to get access to the treatment that he needs if he is sent to Turkey. And the Danish government did a lot of work to try to prove that he still would. And they provided two reports which said that he would have access to hospitals and to medication and that the costs could be heavily subsidised if necessary. Court, by majority, held that the criteria under Papashvili was still met. And that was particularly because the need for daily medication gave rise to a considerable risk of pharmaceutical failure. And it was felt that because he had no family to assist him in Turkey, that he did need to have a regular and personal contact person to ensure that he would actually gain access to the treatment that he needs. And in those circumstances, it was found that the state had not dispelled the real risk about access to treatment. I think this decision is important for two reasons. First of all, it applies the Article 3 medical criteria to a severe psychiatric illness. And some listeners may know that the background case law has indicated that psychiatric illnesses are not always treated in the same way as other forms of illness. And then the other reason I think it's significant is this emphasis on not only availability, but practical access to treatment. And I think that when preparing a case under Article 3 for a claimant, it's sensible to pay attention to the actual facts on the ground for the claimant in the circumstances where they are removed to the country of origin. And just finally, the case was argued in the Grand Chamber in Strasbourg in June, but we are awaiting judgment, and perhaps that will be one for the 2021 roundup.
Absolutely. 2020 was a year involving the examination of discrimination in many guises. We saw, following the death of George Floyd, Black Lives Matter protests held around the world. And on that topic, I highly recommend the podcast episode with Martin Ford QC of OneCore, who is the independent advisor to the Windrush Compensation Scheme on structural racism in the UK generally and at the bar specifically. I also commend an excellent article by Michael Paulin covering race that was published on the UK Human Rights blog. John, what did you make of the Black Lives Matter protests?
Well, I was just struck by the scale of the protests, and I don't have any first-hand experience of mistreatment by the police, but it does seem to me that if you're in a situation where you don't trust that you'll be treated fairly by law enforcement officers who might be armed, I think that taps into really deep feelings of fear and mistrust and indeed alienation. Of course, it's not just confined to law enforcement, and we've been reading many testimonies about systemic racism that is much more widely in society.
Yes, and on that point, Emma, we should also mention the Black Lives Matter movement has prompted quite a lot of soul searching within the legal profession itself. There have been many Black lawyers sharing their stories of discriminatory treatment in the course of their work, typically on social media, criminal barristers mentioning how they've been mistaken by court staff for their own defendant. It's clear that the court service, but also chambers and firms, still got quite a lot of work to do to make sure that everybody feels included.
So looking at a different form of discrimination, my choice for the most significant case of the year concerns Samira Ahmed. In January 2020, which feels like a very long time ago now, listeners may remember that Samira Ahmed, a BBC presenter and journalist, won a decisive employment tribunal victory after she claimed that she had been underpaid by £700,000 for her work compared with Jeremy Vine. The unanimous judgment held that the BBC had failed to prove that this pay gap wasn't because of sex discrimination. And in one of my favourite interviews of the year, I interviewed Shaheen Rahman QC of One Core about the decision, and I highly recommend her analysis of the decision to listeners. But it occurred to me that none of this might have come to light if in July 2017, the BBC had not been required to publish the salaries of those earning more than £150,000 a year, which then demonstrated a significant disparity between male presenters and their female equivalents. This, of course, demonstrates the importance of audits in uncovering discrimination. Since 2017, over 500 BBC employees have had their salaries raised, and following this judgment, settlements were paid to a large number of female BBC employees and former employees. Of course, an interesting coda to that case concerned the Equality and Human Rights Commission's investigation into BBC pay discrimination, which concluded in late 2020 that there had been, in their view, no unlawful pay discrimination. But on to a different EHRC investigation now. We also saw in 2020 the results of the investigation into anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, with the EHRC's report published in late October. And I must say, Alistair Henderson of One Crown Office Row was the lead investigator in that investigation. John, you read this report with interest.
I certainly did, Emma. After Jeremy Corbyn became leader of the Labour Party back in September 2015, Jewish members and commentators in the media expressed deep concern that the atmosphere in the party had become inhospitable for Jews. Where does this come from? Well, before the election of Corbyn as leader, there were warnings that many on the far left had embraced a worldview that was based on long-standing anti-Semitic tropes. This worldview tends to involve adhering to a stereotypical view of Jews as bourgeois, aspirational, and wealthy, though of course many Jews are not. The view tends to treat the Jews as a homogenous bloc and as being unsupportive of the left's project of social justice. So listeners may remember when the former London mayor Ken Livingstone indicated at an internal Labour meeting back in 2012 that he did not expect the Jewish community to vote Labour because they were too wealthy. And he said this despite the Jewish community's long record of support for the Labour Party. This attitude also lends itself readily to conspiracy theories, where the Jews are characterised as the puppet masters of international finance, acting as a tribe to try to exert pressure on global affairs for their own interests. And they're seen as having a dual loyalty, where Jews are treated as being more loyal to fellow Jews than they are to their other fellow citizens. And what this can turn into then is the suggestion that really Jews are not properly British at all. It also tends to involve an implacably hostile view of Israel, which goes well beyond perfectly legitimate criticism of its government's policies. Of course, supporting the Palestinian right to a state or expressing strong criticism of Israeli policies such as settlement building is not anti-Semitic. But this goes far beyond that, and it doesn't see the conflict as one with important considerations on both sides and a need for compromise. It sees Israel as having no legitimacy, no legitimate concerns. And it also accuses Jews of using money and influence to prevent Britain and the United States from working for justice for the Palestinians. There's a willingness to embrace conspiracy theory thinking here too. And listeners might remember that after the killing of George Floyd that we've discussed, it was suggested that the Minneapolis police had learnt the tactic of leaning on a person's neck at seminars given by the Israeli secret services. So you can see there's an attempt to implicate Israel in the death of George Floyd. Now, when Corbyn became leader, many were warning that the Labour Party was becoming home to the proponents of this toxic attitude. And several former long-standing Labour employees, most of whom weren't Jewish, explained why they'd quit their jobs in shock and in frustration at the way that the leader's office was interfering with the process of investigating complaints. In turn, Corbyn's supporters then tried to dismiss these allegations. Finally, in October of last year, EHRC provided its report, and it made three crucial findings. First of all, the Labour Party directly breached the Equality Act by two of its agents unlawfully harassing Jewish people. One of those was Ken Livingstone. Secondly, there were 18 borderline cases in which there was clear harassment committed against Jewish people. That wasn't what was borderline. The borderline point was that it wasn't clear whether the people carrying it out did so as Labour Party agents. They were Labour councillors, local election candidates and CLP office holders, but legally it wasn't totally clear whether they were acting as agents or as private individuals. And then the third finding was that in many more files, said the EHRC, there was evidence of anti-Semitic conduct towards Jewish people by ordinary members of the Labour Party. The conduct was deplorable, but because these ordinary members didn't hold any office in the Labour Party, Labour wasn't directly responsible. These findings are important because some people tried to dismiss this as saying, well, there were only a very limited number of cases of anti-Semitism. What the findings suggest is that there was widespread anti-Semitism, but the EHRC was very careful, rightly very proper, about saying that the Labour Party is only liable when it's clear that it's its agents. And there was also another important finding, which was that within the sample of 70 complaint files, in 23 of those, there was political interference by the leader's office, just as the whistleblowers had said. And that conduct, interfering with the process of investigating anti-Semitism, itself constituted unlawful indirect discrimination against Jewish people. The report concluded that it's regrettable that many of the concerns we raise here were first raised in reports over 4 years ago. This reflects a culture that is at odds with the Labour Party's commitment to zero tolerance. It's hard not to conclude that anti-Semitism could have been tackled more effectively if the leadership had chosen to do so. On the morning of publication, within half an hour, Jeremy Corbyn gave what was a very begrudging non-apology, and he also said that the anti-Semitism problem was dramatically overstated. But the current Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, praised the report as comprehensive, rigorous and thoroughly professional, and promised to take action so that never again would Labour let down the Jewish people. And Labour is now in the process of enacting policies and procedures to implement this, which I think is very encouraging. As a Jew myself, I very much hope that this will lead to real change and heal Labour's recently troubled relationship with the Jewish community.
Thanks, John. I think your description of the report's findings demonstrate exactly why it deserves a spot in our most significant cases or reports of 2020. But we haven't been able to cover every case, every interesting case that came up in 2020. And now is a time for a quick fire round. Mike and John, do you have any runners up that did not make it into your list?
Yes, I have two in the healthcare context, and we won't be forgiven by our colleagues if we don't mention them because they were heavily involved. The first is the Tavistock case, where the High Court upheld a challenge to a hospital's practice of prescribing puberty blocking drugs to children with gender dysphoria. The court held that it was very doubtful that anybody under 16 could lawfully consent to such treatment, given the long-term risks. Jeremy Hyam and Alistair Henderson, who acted for the claimants in that case, And then also, of course, Dolan, which is the failed challenge to the lockdown regulations on human rights grounds. And Philip Haver's QC acted for the claimant in that case. And it's unfortunate that we haven't had time to mention all of these cases, but 2020 was quite an active year.
John, what's on your runner-up list?
Well, there's also the dismissing of the challenge to the third runway at Heathrow, which David Hart QC calls Hamlet without the prince. And if you want to understand what he means by that, you'll have to read the piece on the UK Human Rights blog.
Well, for my part, my two runner-up cases are Swift and Carpenter, obviously the long-awaited judgment on the calculation of accommodation claims in personal injury litigation, which had us all refreshing our understanding of reversionary interest. And then, of course, the very significant case in Maughan and Her Majesty's Senior Coroner for Oxfordshire, in which the Supreme Court held that the standard of proof to be applied where the death might have been caused by suicide or unlawful killing is now to be the balance of probabilities. And we will have more on that in an upcoming episode on Inquest Hot Topics, so listeners should stay tuned. But I must say that no roundup of the defining cases of 2020 would be complete without mentioning the libel trial involving Johnny Depp and the Sun newspaper. For me, one of the more bizarre periods in an already bizarre year was walking along a deserted Fleet Street to Chambers while London was in the height of lockdown, while passing a horde of Johnny Depp supporters hoping to catch a glimpse of their idol. Now, an analysis of that case is beyond the scope of this episode, and if I'm being honest, is beyond the scope of my own legal expertise. But I did find it quite disheartening to read the outpouring of support for Johnny Depp after the judgment was handed down, and the various attacks on Amber Heard on social media, who, it must be remembered, did not personally bring the case. And I thought Helena Kennedy QC put it particularly well when she said that there are still these pervasive myths about the kind of woman who deserves the protection of the law. Battered women have to seem meek and subservient to have our sympathy. And that really struck a chord with me.
I absolutely agree. On a slightly lighter note, there was quite a big moment in the trial where Johnny Depp told the court that the witness statement, which was produced on his behalf, he hadn't read it, which I thought was a real sort of nightmare scenario for any lawyer in the courtroom.
Absolutely, and one that we have all definitely been in. As always, we will post a link to the various judgments, blog posts and podcast episodes cited in today's episode on the UK Human Rights blog. I'd like to thank Simon, our wonderful producer, for his excellent work on the podcast last year, helping us to surpass 400,000 listens. And as we all wait and hope for the success of the vaccine, I very much hope that you will keep listening throughout 2021. But all it leaves me to do now is to thank Mike and John. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Emma. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me and Happy New Year.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.